The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, this time, and I guess the next, we're going to talk a little bit about Christianity and science. What is at stake in this large, large question about the relationship between Christian faith and science? Obviously, at one level, it's a highly charged discussion. There are actually books that are written like The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, or a little bit less charged, History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. And indeed, it is the perception of many people that the two, whatever those two are somehow locking horns all the time and haven't figured out a way to live peacefully without giving up one or the other. Also, Christians, and I think particularly American evangelical Christians at this time, have gotten very, very involved with certain aspects of the debate, usually centering on creation issues, occasionally on other issues like technology or medical ethics. But the creation issue is just huge. I moonlight for the Veritas Forum, which is this wonderful evangelistic organization that goes around to different American universities, not just American, but in North America. And one of the constant topics that we're always being asked to address, and we do, of course, is design, Darwin, days of creation, and things like that. So it's a very front burner issue for many American Christians. But I think what's much more deeply at stake than any idea of war or a particular area of interest like creation is very simply the relationship of God the Creator, and therefore of general revelation, to the legitimate but not always easy calling of science, of discovery, of all the disciplines that relate to science. And we'll get to trying to define that in a minute. So I think there's apologetic issues all over the place. Obviously, we've got to do something about these wars, if there are such. We've got to address hot button issues like Genesis and creation and versus the other models, and guard against both accommodation and naivete. But I think much more important than that is we as Christians who believe in the integrity of creation, we have bifocal vision, we believe it's fallen too, but we believe in the integrity of creation. We have a very exciting opportunity to show how investigation, discovery, invention can play a crucial part in the coming of the kingdom and in God's world and in making of the environment better for habitation and so on. So I used to think that, I wish this issue would go away, of faith and science, because it gets so entangled and so many people are in a shouting match. But I actually am deeply committed to it. And I, you know, when I was a young man, I'd seriously thought of going into science myself. And it's a rich and fascinating discussion, if frustrating at times. Now, where do we go in order to have some kind of clear apologetic stance? First, would somebody close the door for me? Thanks. Helps me concentrate. Well, a little history doesn't hurt, because we learn a lot, or we should, from what's happened in historical circumstances that may give us some better vision for today. And what you find in history is two things. You find, maybe to one's amazement and surprise, that religion in general, and Christian faith in particular, have actually, in a general fashion, been quite nurturing and quite encouraging of scientific enterprise. You can go back to Augustine or Boethius, who were fascinated with astronomy, and you can go back to the Middle Ages, where all kinds of scientific discoveries, as well as inventions. There were many technological revolutions in the Middle Ages. You can go to the Reformation, where at the same time as the Reformation was happening, and maybe partly because of this, there was a burgeoning interest in science, whether it be in the literary field or in astronomy or in the discovery of chemical reactions or all kinds of things. One of the reasons that the Reformation gave such an impetus to the rise of modern science is because it was able to, as it were, demythologize the world in a good way. I think I've told you this before, but the poet Petrarch, in the Renaissance context, was the first person to have climbed a mountain for the simple pleasure of getting to the top. And that may sound like an odd factoid, but it means that previous to him, you didn't go mountain climbing for fun or for exercise or for the view or whatever. Mountains were places where the gods were, the demons were. They were spooky places. You don't go to the mountain. You use it as a symbol, maybe. So there were these breakthroughs at the Reformation. And here's another factoid. People didn't go to the beach for a swim until the 19th century. Water is not for swimming. I mean, they knew how to swim, but they didn't go there, with their parasols and bathing suits, and and the last thing people would do would be to put on a lot of suntan lotion and try to darken your skin. And and the reason is that water is a dangerous place. It's the edge of the world. It's ships go out at great risk, and some of them don't come back. And so there was a sort of demythologizing of the world, and you can find, if you study the history of science, some wonderful connections. For example, the Royal Academy of Science in Great Britain was founded basically by Christians for Christian purposes, which included, interestingly, a lot of things we don't kind of consider strictly scientific, but it was certainly considered that in those days. It was agricultural arts. Now, we do have agricultural science, but there it was big time, because that was a main preoccupation that science was supposed to help us with. Of course, it included astronomy and many other things. And the basic purpose of the Royal Academy was to have high peer review, high standards, so that God would be honored in the way we went around investigating the world, and so on. Now, one can go on. In the 19th century, it was a number of Christians, for specifically Christian reasons, who first suggested that the Earth's time of formation may have been longer than just 6 24-hour periods of time. And there would be ways to look at Genesis that would be perfectly harmonious with a longer period of time. And so forth and so on. So I'm not going to do a history of science here. It's a totally fascinating field. But it doesn't hurt to know that Christianity has been a major force in the rise of science. Now, secondly, of course, there has been conflict. And what do you learn from the conflicts? You know, the Galileo affair was a fascinating time. You know, in the modern eye, you look back rather superciliously on the poor old Catholic Church because of how obscure it was and how silly it was to condemn Galileo. And there is some truth to that. It was a huge mistake, a huge misperception. But what is less understood or less appreciated, perhaps, is that the threat of Galileo was not so much against the Bible, even though some of his critics thought that it was, but the threat of Galileo was against the Aristotelian universe that people for five centuries had embraced since Thomas Aquinas. And it had been so embedded in the mentality of the church and in Christian theology that Aristotle's universe was the best way to understand the way God works and the most compatible with Scripture, that Galileo had a very tough road. Indeed, he was put under house arrest for his controversial books, which suggested that the Earth was not at the center, but that the Sun was at the center of the planetary system. Of course, Copernicus had done this before, and as I mentioned, I think previously, Copernicus's reasons were mathematical and aesthetic, but Galileo's reasons had some measuring devices added to it, which helped make it all the more bizarre that people would tenaciously hold on to an Earth-centered system. And the reason this episode is important is that we do learn that the church errs, and that when someone comes along who proposes a different model, while it may at first look as though this is a complete threat to our understanding of the Bible, God uses general revelation and gifted people to help us look at the Bible in a different light. And of course, people since that time, I mean, including us, we look at the Bible and we see no evidence of an Earth-centered astronomy in any kind of metaphysical way. If ever texts seem to talk about the centrality of Earth, it's because of perspective. It has nothing to do with astronomy. And so, you know, you learn important lessons from the time of conflict, and you do learn that you have to retract things. I forget when, it was fairly recently, the Catholic Church finally retracted its condemnation of Galileo. But you can be wrong. You equally learn from the enormous episode of conflict between Darwin and Darwinism and the defenders of creation. You learn that some of Darwin's discoveries ought to have been listened to. And again, you learn that the Bible doesn't necessarily give you a strictly fixed kind of cosmology that forbids everything that Darwin stood for. But you also learn that Darwin came at a time when people wanted a sure way to oppose the abuses of the church as they saw them. Owen Chadwick, I've mentioned this before, wrote a book called The Secularization of the European Mind in the 19th Century. And his argument is that many of the leaders in secularization, including Darwin, were successful not so much because of the cogency of their arguments. I mean, how many people really did read Origin of Species? How many people read it now? I have it on my bookshelf. I have to admit, I've read the first 10 pages and I've dipped into it, but I've never read it cover to cover. But you just felt like it ought to be true. A church that was resenting the upper middle class for its kind of traditional morality and stifling of different initiatives was a church that ought to be combated. And what's the best way to do that? Well, science. Science combats the church. And so this huge, and that, of course, generated a whole lot of other successive conflicts. You know, from Bultmann, who says that in the age of the electricity and the radio, no one can believe in miracles anymore, to the Scopes trial about an educational policy in Tennessee, which was popularized as the obscure fundamentalists versus the enlightened scientists, to all kinds of crazy debates, including some legitimate ones. We need to learn from these warfares, these conflicts, where the truth is and where we have to wait and just hang on. Now, let me say something about the Scopes trial, because that's another, I think, example of this. Very interesting. You probably, if you saw the movie by with Spencer Tracy and everything, you get a pretty misleading impression of what the Scopes trial was really all about, because the movie did tend to pit a rather obscure popular fundamentalist against a learned lawyer who could make him look pretty silly. I remember the line of argument in the movie was where he was asked, William Jennings Bryan, whether Jonah really lived in the belly of a whale for 3 days. And he said, yeah, that's what the text says, I believe it. And then the guy says, well, it doesn't say a whale, it says a great fish. Now what do you think? You know. Well, this just didn't happen. It was actually a fascinating debate between a populist who wasn't so worried about Darwinism, actually had considerable sympathies with what Darwin was saying about the length of time it may have taken to create the earth and so forth, but who was very worried that parents were losing control of the education of their children. Bryan was a populist who was almost a libertarian in his desire to protect local parent groups and schools from what he saw as the encroaching power of government. Whereas Darrow was he was an atheist lawyer who believed that the only progress that could be made is through a more socialist type of use of education. Now, this trial, to be sure, in the papers and in the media, was made to be the conflict between religion and science, but it actually wasn't particularly. And that just raises a lot of issues. Why? How did it get to that place? Well, it's because Unfortunately, there are Christians who are anti-world, anti-science, who are so threatened by it that they take positions that they don't need to take and become an embarrassment. And also because there is now, in the world of science, more secularism than there ever used to be. Very interesting statistical runs have been done on this. Robert Wuthnow and others, using the Carnegie Institute, have asked the question, in academia, who is most likely to believe in God or to practice religion, and who is less likely? Well, the more scientific disciplines, such as physics and chemistry, will have a higher degree of religiosity than the less, such as the social sciences or the humanities. For example, in one set of data, 49% of the faculty in the social sciences are indifferent or opposed to religion. 46% in the humanities, 41% in biology, and 37% in physical science. Now, why is this? I mean, if science is really in conflict with religion, wouldn't we expect the harder sciences, in a way, to have less religious commitment? But the answer is no, because there's much more turf warfare between the humanities or psychology or philosophy and religion, and Christianity particularly, than there is between the less charged issues in physics and Christianity. Now, there are plenty of physicists who don't believe in God, but there's a lot more who do believe in God or believe in something about mystery in the universe and so on. And one of the reasons is that they're not engaged in a turf warfare. You know, psychology tells us sin isn't real, or guilt is due to circumstance. And religion says, no, it's not. Whereas physics may tell us that the universe is vast, that stars have ages, and the Earth is in one galaxy, and so on. But that isn't per se quite as incompatible on the surface with believing in God. And on the contrary, it's just the opposite. It looks like a wonderful thing that God has created such a world. There is this conflict, and it's real. And so, in an atmosphere where warfare is the metaphor, you're going to find this kind of opposition. Now, one other part of the historical approach which needs to be mentioned before we get into where I think we ought to go with this, and that is, having said all of this about secularization in the sciences and particularly in the humanities, and agreeing fully that the issues are real and science is here to stay, it is curious and maybe troubling that there are some new directions in the sciences themselves which aren't particularly scientific in any traditional sense. With, I guess, the coming of a more postmodern atmosphere, if we really are in one, and certainly due to things like New Age, there's a fascination, even by scientists, and particularly hard scientists, with the irrational, with the mystical. There's a book called The Tao of Physics. There's a book that is called The Dance of the Yuling Masters, A Key to Physics. And these are serious people who are trying to think that there's a Buddhist or a Zen approach to physics, which is going to get rid of all this crazy determinism that is such a threat and in a form of physics. And the introduction of the subjective element in the sciences is a fascinating phenomenon. We spent a little time looking at Thomas Kuhn's work, where he posits that scientific revolutions are really more the result of an inward change of mind about what the rules are for doing discoveries than they are about what's real out there. Now, he's been slapped on the wrist for relativism, and I think rightly so. But there's a trend out there that's looking seriously at science as a non-objective approach. And lots of different discussions about critical realism, veiled reality, and so forth are going on. So I'm thinking with this, that ironically, while Christians have had a lot of problems with science, maybe Christians will end up being the last great defenders of science. Because there's a certain kind of science that is required if we believe in God's world, with its patterns and its covenant promises being kept in God's providence, and we may be some of the more ideological defenders of it rather than its detractors. Okay. So what's at stake? Secondly, the first approach is do some serious historical investigation and learn from the past, and learn also to, demythologize the myth of the war to the extent that you can. In other words, defuse the thing and get it back to some real issues. But then, third, positively, where should we go? Let me give some background here, and then if we have time, I'll go into one or two very specifically scientific issues. By the way, just to add one thing before I go on, there was a recent article in the New Republic, which is a fascinating and maddening magazine that I get, There was a review of two of John Polkinghorne's books. Now, Polkinghorne is a first-rate British scientist. He's a specialist in particle physics, and he has the rare distinction of being both a professor of physics and a doctor of divinity at Cambridge. He's in the Royal Society, and he's written. One book is called Faith, Science, and Understanding, and the other is called The God of Hope and the End of the World. Both of them are about trying to work science and faith together. And the reviewer is a colleague of his at Cambridge named Simon Blackburn, who's done a lot of work on moral theology. He's got a very good book out on human reason called Think. And this article is so emotionally charged that it's almost embarrassing. I'll just read you a couple. First of all, here's his view of science. His view of science is, we evolved only because of a number of cosmic accidents, including the extinction of the dinosaurs some 50 million years ago. Nature shows us no particular favors. We get parasites and diseases and we die. We're not at all that nice to each other. True, we're moderately clever, but our efforts to use our intelligence to make things better for ourselves quite often backfire, and they may do so spectacularly in the near future from some combination of man-made, military, environmental, or genetic disasters. And then he goes on to attack what he calls Polkinghorne's unpromising agenda. He twists and turns things, he teaches us to protect divinity mostly by not thinking the thing through. And he ends up, after attacking all kinds of aspects of these books, by saying, self-deception, in short, is the human lot. And one wonders if Polkinghorne, the scientist, would take the hesitation and the uncertainty and the lack of agreement that have attended certain laboratory observations to be confirmations of their accuracy. I ended Polkinghorne's books with their supreme contempt for philosophical reasoning and historical thinking in despair about humanity's desperate self-deceptions and vanities and illusions. Everything will be all right in the end. We're washed in the blood of the Lamb. We are blessed, and above all, God is on our side. Who could dissent? Fantasy beats reason every time. People believe what they want to believe. I do not know how it is at Princeton, but at Cambridge, there are 8 established chairs in the Faculty of Divinity, but only 2 in the Faculty of Philosophy. Hallelujah. Now, this is an angry British scientist, but it's very typical of the warfare mentality. If you carefully work through Polkinghorne's books, they're actually very, very thoughtful attempts at showing how God the Creator is not an incompatible notion with particle physics as we've understood it. He's not making any claims that are outlandish or obscure. You know, but this guy is upset. And of course, you learn more about the reviewer than the book in such a review. But it's the flavor of it is like that. How do you get past this? How do we get past being on the defensive ourselves? All right, first.
Senator,
yes.
Can you just write his name?
Yeah, Simon Blackburn. Yes.
Do you know him?
The Polkinghorne.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. He may be in your bibliography. Sometime, not now, I guess. But take a look at your bibliography and. I may have cited his books there, because they're good. They're pretty good books. First of all, back to what I said at the beginning. If God is the creator, and if this world is, as Calvin maintained, a theater, and he's probably thinking of Job when he says this. He says this several times in the Institutes. A theater resplendent with God's glory, and if we believe that the cultural mandate is still in place despite the fall, then science becomes a very noble calling to discover the riches and the depths and the details of that theater. Now, in a fallen world, that doesn't mean we're just looking at how beautiful and wonderful things are. Of course, that's part of it. But we're also looking at how things have gone wrong and why they've gone wrong. Scientists, Christians who are called as scientists, therefore aren't there basically just to do apologetics, even though that might be a good byproduct. But they're there as the legitimate calling to discover God's world. Being God's image bearers, we are prophet, priests, and kings under his greater lordship. And part of being a prophet is to name or interpret the world in order to glorify God. And there's a great virtue in looking at the beauty of it. Einstein famously, you know, said that God does not play dice with the universe. And you know, I don't know that he was a Christian, but he was definitely religious and inclined to mysticism. You can actually get a little book of quotes from Einstein about religion, and he says a lot about how absurd it would be that all this could come into place without a God. And if Einstein could go there, it's fine, you know, for lesser minds to do the same. In a self-conscious way. It's a funny story about Einstein. You know, he spent many of his latter years in Princeton, and he used to hang out at the library a lot late at night. And one night, a freshman whose job was to clean up and turn off the lights in the library. He looked over, and there was Einstein poring over his books. And he came over to him and, you know, trying to be friendly. He didn't know who this guy was. He said, "Oh, what you doing here, you know, my friend?" And Einstein looked up. He said, "I'm studying." "Oh," he said, "what are you studying?" And Einstein said, "Physics." And the student said, "Oh, well, I took that last year." Anyway, if these great minds can do that, you know, I mentioned the Veritas Forum. There's a scientist from Harvard, Owen Gingrich, who participates in our fora. He's one of the great astronomers of the world, and you know, he's had Nova named after him. And when he speaks to an audience about Christ, you just listen, you know, because this is not some defensive Christian fundamentalist who's arguing, you know, outside of his depth. You know, he's really seen it. So there's the legitimacy of this calling to show God's glory, but it's also probably more basically just a calling like others to do the work of discovery well. And it raises a lot of questions, of course. What is good medical technology? What is good? What is a good space program? Tremendous area for Christians to be in. Secondly, because of common grace, there will be plenty of good work done without naming the name of Christ. Now, as you know from the common grace debates, there are Christians such as Kuiper who actually believed that mathematics and the hard sciences were neutral. So that you, of course, non-Christians could do that because regeneration or not regeneration weren't in play. Now, I don't agree with Kuiper. I don't think anything's neutral, and nor do I think that science is somehow, or mathematics is sort of less charged when you really think about it, as the statistical survey I mentioned to you suggests. Rather, I think that because of common grace, as Calvin said, the liberal arts, as he called them, are especially places where both the wonder of God's glory can be discovered and the serious problems of a flawed world because of the fall can be proclaimed. Common grace means, therefore, that we can enter into all kinds of partnerships with unbelieving scientists. Kuiper thought there were basically two kinds of scholarship, regenerate and unregenerate scholarship. Now, I appreciate his presuppositionalism there, but it's hopelessly idealistic. In the real world, Christians don't always do Christian scholarship, whatever that is, and then non-Christians may do some because they're in an aegis of common grace. For sure, Christians ought to be looking for the Christian way to do things. George Marsden wrote a great book called The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship, where he pleads that scholarship done by Christians and with some Christian purport be recognized in modern universities more than it is. But I think you have to be very careful here that not to think that because you're a Christian, you will automatically do things in a Christian way. Peer review is a good idea for Christian scholars, even though we may be uncomfortable with the results. When we write books or we do our scientific studies, we should subject it to whosoever. Now, we have the right to disagree with our reviewers, of course. And it's occasionally possible that one of the reasons they disagree is because they don't like our Christianity. But usually it's to advance the cause of scholarship, and it's okay to do some of that together with those who aren't believers. Now, third, there will be true areas of conflict. What are they going to be? Well, you never know for sure, but there can be ethical areas of conflict. Developing, you know, the best way to euthanize people. You might be doing terrific technology and science, but you're up against a conflict that should prevent you from going in that direction. Developing, I don't know, biological weapons for the purpose of mass destruction. You know, I'm it's broad strokes here, but you can see where I'm going. There are some obvious areas of you just don't go there. More subtly, there are places where our presuppositions come in, and we want to be self-critical and suspicious and be careful with them, because it could develop into an area of true conflict. Now, I'm going to dare open the can of worms here of Genesis and the days of creation. And we may not finish today. I may have to spill over to Wednesday. But here I think we have a discussion where there is real conflict, but there's also illusory conflict on both sides. The real conflict would be, of course, if it could be proved, based on the working assumption that evolution is autonomous and self-generated dynamic, that Adam didn't exist or was the result of a succession of lesser atoms that suddenly developed on its own into a man. Or if in honest scientific ways it could be proved that the accounting of Genesis for the way things came into being by God's fiat or by God's declaration was utterly impossible. I mean, that would be just a conflict. Because what's at stake in Genesis is God the Creator and the unique creation of mankind. And there are plenty of areas of conflict like that which one could cite. However, how do we know when we have a real conflict? Well, this requires two things. It requires honesty at the level of scientific discovery, and it requires honesty at the level of biblical hermeneutics. And I'm not sure all the answers are in. I'm pretty sure they aren't. But I've messed around with this quite a lot because it's a area of interest for me, and I've looked at a great deal of scientific argument. And some of it, at least, seems more motivated by an anxiety to get a certain cosmology defended, whether it be just materialistic evolution or some other version, than by a willingness to discover what's really out there. I've followed with great interest the career of Stephen Jay Gould. He was at the college that I attended, and my daughter actually took a course from him. And he's a fascinating person. He's got a lot of personal charisma. He's got an airtight mind. He's written extensively on evolutionary theory. He's also written about baseball. And he died a couple of years ago. He's one of these persons that I think is though very, very good at what he does, negatively driven by an attempt somehow to show that a creator is not necessary. He doesn't argue that there is none. He just says we don't need that. And you know what he did. One of the things he did, kind of fascinating, it became quite clear that classical Darwinism, or even bits and pieces of neo-Darwinism, which is genetic science, weren't able to show the great diversity of the present condition of species, and particularly human species, that the amount of time given for it, even though it was quite a bit longer than what the Bible seems to give as its impression, is possible. So in other words, how do you get so complex in such a relatively short time, even on an evolutionary basis? So because we cannot, almost by definition, find the so-called missing links. You know, how did amphibians become land creatures? How did we get a vertebra? All the famous missing links. Because of that, we need something else to explain the diversity. So he simply calls it punctuated equilibrium. Punk ek, as it's called. Which means that for reasons we don't understand, but at various times which we can approximate, there was a giant leap forward, way beyond mutations. It was a punctuation. It was gone. We had and then it started something else, and through these sort of giant leaps, we get the complexity. Now, in a way, that's a safe thing to say because there's no way to go back there and prove it. But in another way, it looks suspiciously like I want to get my evolution cake and I want to eat it too, and so I throw this thing in. There's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty if you're going to be honest. I'm not sure we want to go altogether where the creationists go and utterly question all dating methods, radioactive carbon, magnetic dating, and so forth. But there are at least some legitimate questions to ask there. In other words, it would seem that things come gift-wrapped sometimes in a package that's a little bit too neat. Now, on the other side of it, could it be that many Christians are defending something about Genesis that isn't there or isn't meant to be there? I'll start more narrowly by saying that Genesis, of course, on the surface of it, looks like a series of 24-hour days. However, if you look again, you might find that the notion of day, right back there in the text of Genesis, isn't quite as clock-driven as it would later become. You'll have some trouble with the idea that it was only on the fourth day that the sun and the moon came to measure the times. What about before? You'll have some trouble figuring out whether you can date the distance between the first generations of people and the more datable generations, starting with Abraham and so on. And you may be defending more than you need to. If you're going to go there, you're also going to have some difficulty figuring out how come vegetation occurs before the sun. Don't we need photosynthesis for that? And then you might be saying, you might find yourself trying to do things like, well, what about that light at the very beginning? Maybe that was a kind of sun-like light that, or maybe God just did a miracle. You just get yourself tangled up in trying to work out the details. Could it be that the intention of the book of Genesis is not to give us a detailed cosmology that answers some of the current questions that we might ask of the text? Could it be that the text of Genesis isn't meant to do that? It's meant to give us truth, and I would add historical truth. But what is that historical truth? What details do we take over into our categories, and what do we accept in more generally biblical terms? So the simple way of saying that is Genesis 1 really a book that answers scientific questions about about how it all happened between the first moment when God brought the world into being and the emergence of humankind. I'm not sure that it is. I'm not saying it has no relationship to what went on. I think, of course, it does, because it's the truth, and it has every relationship. But I just think that we need to do more hermeneutics and more science before we can get some approximations of what went on, if we'll ever get them at all. I am almost equally uncomfortable about harmonies that some Christians have tried to make based on the idea of theistic evolution. Or the day-age theory. It says, you know, we don't have days here. The yom can mean long period of time. I think, again, you're accommodating a kind of question that the text isn't meant to answer. In Davis Young's work, which I admire a lot, and I think he's helped us to get past some of the simplistic stuff of the creationists, he nevertheless, I think, goes out on a limb when he says he has these schemes where, how do you explain agriculture, or how do you explain plants without photosynthesis? Well, you have day one, day two, day three, day four, and you see there's an overlap because these aren't strictly sequential. So the day four has the sun, and that shows how, at least in part of day three, you could have plants and vegetation and so forth. And he gets into this overlap theory. Let's just close with this. Okay, I'll leave you in suspense. We'll get back to this next Wednesday.